It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Kathy Buchvar is resigning as Secretary of the Commonwealth, but not over her handling of the 2020 election and the mail-in ballot process. Governor Tom Wolf said in a statement that the Department of State didn't properly advertise a proposed constitutional amendment that would give survivors of sexual abuse more time to sue the perpetrators. Katie Meyer is WHYY's political reporter. She's looking into what all this means. Thanks for being with us, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Secretary Buchvar is leaving her position, according to the Wolf administration. Has she effectively been fired?
I mean, I think that it might be sort of a mutual understanding at this point. But yeah, I mean, this was a major error. And I think it's, you know, rises to the level of there needs to be some accountability for this happening. She says she only found out about the error, which we can, you know, get into the details this week. But she says, you know, it still happened on her watch, so she's stepping down.
Mm-hmm. For a proposal to become an amendment to the state constitution, it must get passed in two consecutive legislative sessions and then be okayed by the voters. How exactly are proposed constitutional amendments supposed to be advertised?
Yeah, so this is, it's part of the Constitution that goes back many, many years. So, you know, some people have said it's a little bit dated, but it has to be advertised in multiple newspapers in every county in the state. And that has to happen on two separate occasions after the bill passes both times, and it has to happen before a legislative election. So the last legislative election that would have fallen under this rule was the 2020 election. So in the 3 months leading up to the 2020 election, you know, DOS was supposed to be advertising this new amendment, and they did not.
Mm-hmm. They just forgot? Do we have any indication of why they didn't?
You know, we don't really. Wolf said in his statement that it was human error. But, you know, it's very strange. I mean, there were multiple other amendments that were also, you know, kind of in the same situation, and those were advertised. I've gotten confirmation that that happened. I talked to Mark Rossi, who is a state representative who's been heavily involved in pushing this amendment, and he's calling for an investigation. He wants to know exactly what went wrong.
Mm-hmm. It could have been on the ballot this year, correct?
Yes. So the soonest it could have been on the ballot, and in fact, it was expected to be on the ballot for the May primary election. So that was coming right up. And so right now, you know, the bill is on its second round of passage. It's already gotten through the House. And it was actually just like on the day that they said that this giant mistake had taken place, it was supposed to pass the Senate Judiciary Committee. So this has really just kind of come as a shock to everybody. It was moving right along.
Mm-hmm. So therefore, the process is to start over again. What's the earliest it could go before the voters then?
So, yes, if they do the amendment again, it's probably going to take, you know, another 2 years, maybe a little bit less to get on the ballot again, depending on how fast they can go. But lawmakers are also talking about doing it just as a simple bill. If that happens, it doesn't have to go to a referendum or anything. They can just pass it into law ASAP and the governor could sign it. It's not clear if that's how they're going to go. That would leave them open to being sued potentially by the Catholic Church, which has always been sort of opposed to this measure. There's also talk of an emergency constitutional amendment, which I have never seen done before, but does exist. The question becomes, is this an emergency? You know, Mark Rossi, the state rep who supports this, argues that, yeah, it is, because people need, you know, accountability for horrible, you know, crimes that they say have been done to them.
So the amendment, the proposal, what exactly would have it allowed abuse survivors to do?
Yeah, so this was part of a package of bills. They really sort of came to a head after, you'll recall, there was a 2018 report on abuse for decades and decades in the Catholic diocese in Pennsylvania. And so these were in response to that. Part of the package, which already passed as a simple bill, basically got rid of the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse and sexual abuse crimes going forward. This part was the more complicated part, and it was retroactive. So what this amendment will do, if it becomes law eventually, is open a 2-year window for survivors of sexual abuse as children to retroactively sue their abusers, even if the statute of limitations on their cases have already expired.
Finally, Katie, Any word on what procedures the state might put in place to ensure this human error doesn't happen again? Or is it just that nature, human error, and it could happen again?
Yes. So Governor Wolf, in the statement that he put out, he did actually make note of this. He said that there would be new controls, basically additional tracking and notifications in the Department of State to make sure, you know, what he said, similar failings don't happen in the future with constitutional amendments. And he also, Wolf also says he asked the state inspector general to review everything and make recommendations if they can improve the process more.
Katie Myers, a political reporter with WHYY. Thanks so much for your time, Katie.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Black and Hispanic children are less likely to receive medical imaging tests as part of an ER visit compared to white children. That's according to new research from UPMC Children's Hospital and the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Jennifer Marin is the lead author of that study. She's an associate professor of pediatrics, radiology, and emergency medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Welcome to The Confluence, Dr. Marin.
Thank you.
Your study shows that black children are 18% less likely to get imaging tests during emergency department visits compared to white children, and Hispanic children 13% less likely. How did you come up with those 18% and 13% figures?
So when we look at the rates of imaging between the two, or the different groups, based on race and ethnicity, we want to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples. So we want to make sure that we're accounting for the patient's age and their gender and how severe they are, how injured they are, and factors like that. And when we do that, then we end up understanding a little bit better what the likelihood is that that child would get imaging. And that's where we saw the differences.
Mm-hmm. So why is it? Is it a matter of implicit bias? Is it insurance? What are some of the factors here?
We weren't able to answer that question through this study, but we can certainly hypothesize. You know, Kevin, your point is a good one. Is there implicit bias playing a role? That's very probably true. There's probably several reasons that contributed to the differences. We know from other studies that physicians do have an implicit bias and do favor white patients. There may have been language barriers that can play a role. There's other factors like whether a child has a primary care physician, and sometimes expectations are set at the time of the primary care visit. And so a patient may come in with the expectation that they're going to get imaging. Families and patients are very savvy. There can be a lot of anxiety, and there can be just preferences when patients come in. We think that's probably more likely in white families that they come in, and the expectation is that there is going to be imaging.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the common medical issues that require imaging that could be missed if imaging is not done?
Right. So that's probably not such an easy question to answer. It really depends. But certainly, you know, the ones that we think about the most in the emergency department would be a patient who comes in with head trauma. We want to make sure that if it's indicated that we get a CT scan of the head. A patient who comes in with abdominal pain, if we're worried about appendicitis.
Mm-hmm. When a provider decides maybe not to prescribe an imaging test, it can impact whether or not the child receives care that they need beyond the emergency room. What sort of impacts does this have maybe long-term on the child?
Right. So one thing that our study was not able to show, but that really bears discussing, is the issue of who got the better care, right? So we know that white children are getting imaged more, and we know that Black and Hispanic children are getting imaged less. And I think it's probably both. It could be that minority patients are not getting the imaging that they need. And of course, that then leads to complications down the road. But the counter to that is that white children may be getting imaging that they don't need. And we don't talk enough about unnecessary tests and low-value care, so care that's delivered that's really not indicated.
As a professor, as a doctor, as someone who works for children and with children, What are some of the ways this study is limited, and what do you still want to know so that you can be a better provider to children?
You know, we looked at 13 million emergency department visits. So the study is fairly robust in terms of the sample size. The take home here really is this is an issue. There are disparities here. Some children are getting good care. Some children are getting suboptimal care. And I think that when physicians and providers read the test, really the take home is this is happening and we need to examine this with a personal lens, meaning, you know, take this to where you work and evaluate your practice, evaluate your department's practice, your hospital's practice. Mm-hmm.
Is it as simple as from your study, you know, a lot of the what? How many Black children with visits to the ER received imaging versus how many white children and their visits to the ER, but it's the why they got it that you're still searching for, or why they didn't get it?
Even more importantly might be to really determine interventions and solutions that can try to reduce the differences. Mm. So, for example, there's a lot of data on what are called clinical decision rules. And these are basically guidelines for physicians. And they're based on evidence and studies that have been done about best practices. So I'll give you an example. We have very well done guideline for head trauma. So when a child comes in and they hit their head, we can consult this guideline when we see them in the emergency department. We can then sort of follow this algorithm and determine, well, what's this child's risk of having bleeding in their head from this head trauma? And if the risk is really very, very low, then we probably shouldn't be getting a CT in that child. So I think implementing some of these decision rules on a consistent basis when they're available has the potential to reduce some of these disparities.
Dr. Jennifer Marin is an associate professor of pediatrics, emergency medicine, and radiology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And she is the lead author of a study on disparities when it comes to imaging tests for white children versus Black children and Hispanic children. Thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Just 7 games into a shortened 56-game NHL season, Penguins general manager Jim Rutherford, who oversaw 2 Stanley Cup championships for the Penguins, just resigned. Patrick Alvain is the interim GM. Rob Rossi is a senior writer covering the Penguins for The Athletic. Were you as shocked, seemingly, as Penguin ownership was?
Yes, I was. I will say this. In the entirety of the Sidney Crosby era, which I've been fortunate to cover all of it, this is maybe the only story where I didn't have any idea this was coming. And to be perfectly candid, Kevin, I probably should have been aware something was up because about a month before we published a story that I wrote in which Jim Rutherford talked about how mentally and emotionally the past offseason was the toughest of his career.
Jim Rutherford is 71. He cited in his original statement, announcement, the often vague personal reasons, but said physically he was fine. He only had 5 months remaining on his contract. So what have you learned? Have you been able to piece together anything, any little hints of the big why?
I don't think there's one thing. You know, there wasn't a contract dispute. The Penguins had talked to Rutherford in the fall and said, look, we want you to be our GM. We want to do another 3-year extension, but we're not going to do any extensions or contracts for anybody but players while we still have employees who we haven't been able to bring back. And remember, the NHL hasn't had revenue coming in from games, which is pretty much 70% of their revenue streams since March. There was no trade that he was in the process of making that ownership scuttled. He'd been allowed to run the team the way he wanted to run the team for the most part, based off my conversations with him and my conversations with other people in days recent. I think Jim might not have been processing situations maybe the same way others were. And by that, I mean, I think something that might not have been as big a deal to, say, their CEO, David Morehouse, might have been a bigger deal to Jim. And I do wonder if part of that is because Jim hasn't been in the office much. He's very much a tactile politician. That's the way I describe him. He likes that sort of personal connection. He hasn't been able to get that. And I think there were just some smaller issues, maybe some smaller disagreements that will happen with anybody in any business, any way of life, that Jim was making bigger than they were. He's an emotional, impetuous guy sometimes, by his own admission. He does have a weakness for sort of living in a moment. And I think in this particular case, he lived in a moment, told them he was quitting on last Tuesday before the game in Boston. They were like, look, let's talk after the game. He told them again after the game. And then he quit again. So that, you know, he quit three times in a matter of like 16 hours. At some point, I think they were like, we better take his resignation because he doesn't seem like he wants to do this anymore.
Now, Rutherford and team ownership, they offered the traditional complimentary words about one another. Rutherford told you these guys are the best owners in all of sports. Any reason not to believe that?
Well, I don't know if I agree that they're the best owners in all of sports.
Well, okay. Any reason not to believe that the feelings were genuine?
If ownership didn't really like Jim, there was enough that had gone wrong the past 3 years. This is a guy that made 12 trades per season the last three seasons. Look, Kevin, if you're making 12 trades per season, something's not right. Usually a general manager that makes five in a season has made a good many. So they haven't prevented him from doing any of that. And again, they told him they'd like to have him back. So I think there was a real good personal relationship there. Maybe if there wasn't, Jim Rutherford would have been replaced sooner instead of having the chance to resign when he did.
So possible replacements, maybe your top three?
That's a really good question because the list keeps changing. But, you know, as of us talking, I would say their number one preference is the current New Jersey general manager, Tom Fitzgerald, who was a longtime Penguins employee. And if the Penguins could get permission to talk to him, they'd hire him on the spot. After that, I would say look to the names of Ron Hextall.
Former Philly GM.
Yes, and former Penguins antagonist as a goalie with the Flyers. And, you know, another name I think to watch for here is John Ferguson Jr. At a very young age, he got his dream job, that being the general manager of the Maple Leafs. Didn't work out. He's currently with Boston as the personnel director, and he might be a dark horse that nobody's talking about enough.
Rob Rossi is a senior writer covering the Penguins for The Athletic. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.